From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Sarah Irvin.
This morning we speak with psychologist Dr. Melissa Goldberg-Mentz, who will discuss a guide for parents and caregivers of children who have been traumatized, how to recognize it, and what to do to promote healing and recovery.
Then, Chad Bracklesberg, director of the Utah Avalanche Center, will be here to talk about one of the best fundraising parties of the year coming up on September 8th. It's the 29th annual Backcountry Benefit.
And finally, Chris Magrill is the director of the Summit Challenge. It takes place on Saturday, August 27th. It's a fully supported bike ride through the scenic mountains of northern Utah. It raises money for the National Ability Center Adaptive Cycling and Mountain Bike Programs. We hear a lot about PTSD and about trauma, both childhood and adult trauma. Our guest is Dr. Melissa Goldberg-Mentz, and she is passionate about providing evidence-based care to children, adolescents, and adults who have experienced trauma. She is a clinical assistant professor at Baylor College of Medicine and has written a new book about childhood trauma. It's called Has Your Child Been Traumatized? How to Know and What to Do to Promote Healing and Recovery. Dr. Goldberg-Mentz, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's great to have you.
Hi, thank you for having me on to chat about this important topic.
It's a really important topic. And my first question surrounds, you know, at some point in all of our lives, there has most likely been some sort of trauma. There's either little bits of trauma that happen through our lives, say bullying, we get bullied in school, or there's some huge event that creates some PTSD. How do you differentiate between those two?
Oh, that is such a wonderful question to start us off. So I'm going to start by explaining a different term, and that is adverse events or potentially traumatic events. So these are the things that you're referring to. It could be bullying, car crash, something like that, things that are very common. And in fact, what we know is that most kids experience at least one type of adverse event before their 18th birthday. Now, whether these adverse events turn into trauma is something that is dependent on the individual who experiences them.
Well, a lot of times we don't even know ourselves until maybe later on in life when we start exhibiting either behaviors or way we react to certain situations that make us wonder where that came from. So how do we as parents maybe recognize this in our children from certain behaviors they may be exhibiting?
Sure. So what I usually tell parents is to look for a change in baseline. So is your child who's normally a great sleeper suddenly waking up with nightmares or struggling to fall asleep or sleeping a lot more than usual? Is your child who normally loved snack time and ate three hearty meals a day now seeming more picky or just not hungry? Are they struggling in friendships more or in school more? So any changes from baseline behaviors would be a red flag to me, especially after experiencing something scary.
So that's really interesting, right? Because when you talk about childhood, there are obviously these developmental milestones that children go through and natural changes in behavior and attitude and, even just sleep patterns, all of it. How do you recommend to parents to identify what is something that's sort of a natural developmental change versus something that might be a result of, you know, dealing with some unknown trauma?
Sure, absolutely. So I think I'll start with what you ended with, which was some unknown trauma. So, what I'd love is for parents to be involved in their kids' lives and to know if something scary happens. So with adults, sometimes we see after an adverse event, they might not have post-traumatic stress symptoms right away, and they could develop much later in life. With kids, it is much more common that if they're going to have a response or a reaction, you're going to see it, you know, if it was a car crash, for example, in the weeks following the car crash. And I think I'll even add to that, kids who experience something like a car crash, it's normal to have, say, a nightmare or trouble sleeping or something like that in the week after the car crash. That would not indicate to me that that child has been traumatized. What we're concerned about is when these things persist. Now, the other part of your question was, you know, how do we know if this is just a normal, like my kids growing up and becoming a teenager and now they're staying up all night? And one thing to look for is there distress around it? So is your kid getting in bed at the normal time, tossing and turning, getting out of bed, complaining to you that they can't sleep? Or is this a kid who, you know, now friends are staying up later, they're texting on their phone, they're looking at TikTok, whatever, and they're enjoying themselves?
No, that makes absolute sense. And when I was reading through the book, you know, one thing occurred to me, and Lynn kind of asked it at the beginning, but, you know, is trauma something that is clinically defined, or is it something that is more personally experienced? You know, I kind of think of that smiley face scale when you go to the doctor's office about, you know, how much pain are you in? And I always laugh at that, right? Because it's my pain. So I could tell you that it's a six, but for somebody else, it might be a three. You know, is trauma sort of that way too? Each person experiences something differently, but the important thing is how they're internalizing it, or is there some sort of universal clinical definition?
So I am going to go with both. I think that there are definitely individual differences in how people experience trauma, just like you were describing. And at the same time, there are a number of symptoms, we call them post-traumatic stress symptoms, they're symptoms we see pop up after someone's been traumatized. And so these symptoms include intrusive re-experiencing symptoms. So this would be things like nightmares, flashbacks, or just having thoughts or images really pop in your head about the scary thing that happened when you don't want them there. Also, avoidance symptoms. So trying really hard not to think about, talk about, or be reminded of reminders of the scary thing that happened. Having negative thoughts and feelings about the scary thing that happened. And hyperarousal symptoms. So just difficulty with concentration, feeling your heart beat really fast, sweating, shaking, trembling, feeling jumpy, that sort of thing. So all of those types of symptoms are post-traumatic stress symptoms. So when we look at somebody who's been traumatized, that's what we're going to see, and that's what we'd be looking for. And what we know is that no two traumatized people are going to have the exact same symptom constellation.
I'm wondering, Melissa, about what are those questions that will trigger conversation? I know as an adult that handling PTSD now in therapy, there are things like, is it EMDR? I always get the acronym mixed up, but it's a way of healing, but it takes you into the trauma to really almost re-experience it so you can then figure out how to cope with it and let it go. And so while we don't want to take our kids back into that moment of traumatization, we do want to find out the questions to ask, and we want to find out what happened, right? So what do we ask?
Oh my goodness, I'm so glad that you asked that. So I think what you're talking about is any type of exposure therapy. So EMDR, like you mentioned, does have exposure as a component, as does all of the other evidence-based gold standard treatments for post-traumatic stress, things like cognitive processing therapy and prolonged exposure therapy. So I once heard this really great metaphor about how to explain it. And so let's just say that here with us, there was a little baby tiger in the room with us. And it was a little cute, but also a little bit scary. And you've got some meat lying around as part of your lunch. So you grab the meat and you toss it out the door, and the baby tiger goes away, and immediately you feel better. Until the next day, of course, when that tiger comes back, and that tiger is a little bit bigger because you fed it and a little more insistent, but you have meat again. So you toss the tiger some more meat, and so on and so forth until you've got a full-grown tiger staring you down in the recording studio. So that is sort of explains the relationship between anxiety and avoidance. And so what we know is that while it is unpleasant to re-experience and talk about this, it doesn't feel great. What we know is that when we avoid it, it becomes scarier and it interferes with our lives even more. So what we have to do is sit in the room with the tiger. We have to talk about what we experienced in a sort of helpful therapeutic way, not just sort of like ruminating on it. But that is why we process it. And so we do the same thing with children in therapy, is we revisit it and we help them learn that they are safe now. And that is what helps us target those post-traumatic stress symptoms.
And as a parent, how do we bring up these conversations? I mean, my children are now in their 20s, and just like I'm sure my mother wondered about me when I was young or an adolescent, you know, what trauma has gone on in your life? How do you start the conversation so that you are recognizing it right away before it becomes a big, huge, growling tiger?
Right. Sure. Absolutely. So I think you can start the groundwork for this whenever kids are young, whenever something scary happens. So say you, something scary happened to you at work or in your day. What I love for parents to do is to start some sort of check-in process, whether it's around the dinner table or at night before going to bed. With really young children, we might call this warm fuzzies and cold pricklies, where you share something about your day that made you feel warm and fuzzy and something that made you feel cold and prickly. And as your children age, this could just be sort of like a share the highs and lows of your day. And if you get them used to this when they're young, they'll feel more comfortable sharing as they get older. Of course, you know, as they approach teenagehood, their comfort levels with this may decrease. It's sort of like a natural growing up process. But hopefully, you know, when something scary happens in their day, they'll feel like they can turn to you to share with you about it.
Yeah, I think that's a really great set of advice. You know, just create those open lines of communication. And I'm sort of curious also, you know, obviously this book was written for parents, you know, has your child been traumatized, how to know and what to do to promote healing and recovery. I'm curious because, you know, it's obviously not just parents who are interacting with children. To what extent do you feel that teachers or coaches or, you know, other adults that are involved in children's lives, you know, are there tips or suggestions that you have for how those, you know, individuals might reach out and create some of those open lines of communication? And really, truly, do you feel that schools and, you know, youth athletics, things like that, are equipped to do so?
Yeah, wonderful question. So the book really focuses on caregivers. And at the same time, a lot of these skills would be very helpful to anyone who's interacting with children on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, just one example of that and how to create an open line of communication would be a skill like normalizing feelings. So, for example, today's actually my kid's first day of school. And I would love for teachers, you know, when kids are coming in and feeling nervous about the first day, which is a totally normal process. I know that probably every other kid in my daughter's pre-K class is feeling nervous. For the teachers to be able to normalize that. And if a kid expresses, you know, that they're feeling nervous or they're feeling scared, for a teacher to be able to say something like, wow, that is so normal. I bet a lot of your friends here in class are also feeling that way. That'll help a kid feel not alone and just put them more at their ease. And so this is a skill that I think is not just great for traumatized children, but for kids who have feelings. So for every kid, essentially.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's the first day of school here as well in the Park City School District. And there were a lot of nervous looking kids on the drive-in, you know, standing at the bus stops and whatnot. I think nervous and excited. So big day. I'm curious because, you know, speaking of schools, one of the, I think, big topics is obviously around resources and, you know, schools obviously need to have enough teachers, but also in terms of, you know, some of those additional resources, counselors, things along those lines. You know, there's a lot of debate locally here and nationally about, you know, mental health services for children. Do you have, you know, thoughts on what the ideal scenario would be for, you know, mental health services and resources, counseling services at schools?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. So, gosh, I think that ideally, and this is like I'm living in my fantasy world, that kids would be able to receive therapy at school. And the reason for that is I think that there are so many barriers to therapy. You know, parents are busy, parents are overworked and overwhelmed, and it can be really hard to get your kid to a weekly therapy session. But if therapists were sort of like built in into the schools, and I know that some school systems already have this, which is wonderful, that would just overcome a huge barrier to treatment, because the kids at school every day. You're not going to have kids showing up late or not showing up at all, problems with transportation, things like that. So I would love for kids to be able to receive therapy at school. Also psychiatry. So I don't know where you guys are, if this is the case at all, but here in Houston where I am, there's sometimes an 8-week wait for child psychiatrists, and it can just be so hard to connect kiddos with the services they need. But if we had somebody who was like in the schools, I think that would also overcome a barrier like that.
Well, continuing on this question, Melissa, I'm wondering, you know, if I think about my kids' schools when they were growing up, you know, maybe you have an elementary school of, say, 400 kids. You've got one school counselor. And I'm wondering if that, or maybe two. I don't know how it is now. But that certainly seems like the numbers, you know, the ratio is just not very good there. And how much are our teachers trained even to handle or recognize this sort of trauma in their children, in their students?
Right. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And especially because with trauma, some of those, we can see a lot of behavioral changes. And so for some kids, it might be an increase in minor misbehavior, like more whining, more tantrums, talking back, being sassy, that sort of thing. And I think a lot of teachers are trained to know what to do in that situation. But with trauma, we also see some increase in major misbehavior. So things like destruction of property, the hurting, kids hurting themselves or trying to hurt other kids. And those things can feel a lot more overwhelming.
Yes. I wanted to focus a little more on recognizing the trauma in our children. And I think because it confounds me a bit, and I know that, you know, some children are very intuitive and really pick up on things. I knew someone who had a child who at about age 6 or 7 started having these nightmares in the middle of the night, really kind of scary nightmares, scared the parents. And this was, you know, what I would consider a very intuitive child. That child somehow on a subconscious level knew that there was unrest in the family. In fact, the parents were eventually they ended up divorcing, but there was that kind of very subtle, you know, not a lot of arguing or anything like that. But somehow that 6 or 7-year-old picked up on it. So I'm wondering about, you know, how often our children really know when there's something going on, even if it's not an overt sort of trauma.
Sure. Oh, that is such a wonderful question. And, you know, I'm not surprised to hear that at all. Our children are so wise. And even if they can't put into words what they're picking up on, they know, hey, something's different and it doesn't feel good. You know, and I think it could, they pick up on it in so many different ways. So this is one thing I've been seeing a lot with the return to school. So a lot of kids are nervous about, you know, the normal things. Does my haircut look dorky? Who am I going to sit with on the first day? Things like that. But parents are more worried about gun violence and COVID and things like that. And kids are picking up on their parents' anxiety, you know, whether it's just like feeling a little bit nervous, feeling a little bit more on edge, your kids picking up on that. And some of my kids are wondering like, oh gosh, do I have something bigger to worry about now? So yes, kids are so good at picking up on our distress.
That's a really excellent point. And I think, you know, we live, it's hard to know if we are living in sort of just normal times, but we have access to more information. And therefore we as adults are potentially living in a little bit more anxiety, sort of almost existentially, right? There's a lot going on in the world. And are we conveying that to our children, either consciously or subconsciously? To what extent do you think it's a good idea for parents to be pretty open with our kids, obviously age appropriately, but you know, if they hear us talking about a school shooting, or if they hear us talking about something, you know, like the war in Ukraine, something to that extent that is obviously so far beyond what's going to impact them on a daily basis, should we be talking about that more openly just so that they're not wondering, or do you think that's not a good idea?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea, actually. I'm glad you asked, because kids are going to hear about it. And if they don't hear about it from you, they're going to see it online. Kids are so online these days, or, you know, hear about it at school from their friends. So what I encourage parents to do is to answer any questions their kids might have. So, oh my gosh, yeah, you heard about that. What questions do you have about it? To just open the door. And not only does this help you answer their questions in a more like appropriate way than what they might find on the internet, say, but it also gives your kid this message that when they're confused about something, or when they hear something upsetting, they can turn to you with any questions that they may have.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. We just have a couple more minutes, so I did want to quickly ask, you know, obviously you wrote this book. Curious if you thought that there was a sort of a gap in the research or resources for caregivers to deal with childhood management, and for those listening, obviously we encourage them to get your book, but also, are there resources online that you would recommend, either through your research efforts or others?
Yes, definitely. So for those two questions, I'll answer the last one first. So yeah, in addition to my book and my website, which is just melissagoldbergmentz.com, I love the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. So it's nctsn.com. They have some fabulous resources. So I always point parents there. And then to your first question, actually. Yes. So there are so many great books out there about how to foster resilient children. And I love those books. As a parent and a psychologist, I've read them myself, and they're fabulous. But there was a big gap for parents in knowing, okay, like, yes, I want to raise a resilient child, but something scary has already happened. What do I do? So, yes, so because of that gap in the literature, that's why I wrote that book. And of course, there are also a lot of resources on this written by therapists for therapists, but not too many for parents. So, yes, that's why I wrote the book.
The book is, again, Has Your Child Been Traumatized? How to Know and What to Do to Promote Healing and Recovery. Our guest is Dr. Melissa Goldberg-Mentz, and you can find all of this information on her website, Melissa Goldberg-Mentz. That's M-I-N-T-Z. Melissa, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. It's a really important conversation, so thank you.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
And our next guest this morning in studio with us, the one, the only, Chad Bracklesburg, director of the Utah Avalanche Center. You know, it's never too early to start thinking about snow. I know it's hot out there, but the winter is coming. And it really means that we should be thinking about snow safety, especially now that we are starting to just see the little signs of fall. And Chad is here to preview the upcoming annual fundraiser, the 29th annual Backcountry Benefit, which benefits, of course, the Utah Avalanche Center, coming up on Thursday, September 8th. Chad, thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So this is obviously, you know, a fan favorite event, and we'd love to get it on everybody's calendar again, Thursday, September 8th. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of what folks can expect and how this event has grown over the years?
Yeah, you know, the Backcountry Benefit is the kickoff to winter for us and for a lot of the backcountry communities. So we love that everybody comes out. For the 29th year, it's really unbelievable that we've been doing it for that long. It's the largest backcountry fundraiser and event and party that we have each year. We're expecting close to 1,400 people to come down, and we have live music. We have a large silent auction, an opportunity drawing, food, vendor booths, drinks from Old Town Cellars, Uinta Brewing, and Dented Bricks. So there's really a little bit of things for everyone. It's a great time to either think ahead and bid on some items in the silent auction to get your kit set up for winter, or buy some gifts ahead of time for fall, and really just reconnect with those winter ski and riding partners that you maybe haven't seen since you put away the gear last spring.
And could you tell folks who are listening where the event takes place?
The event is in the Black Diamond Equipment parking lot in Salt Lake City. So that's 3900 South and 2000 East. And it's we rope off the entire parking lot. We have a huge 50 by 70 tent. And yeah, it's party headquarters there. And we're looking forward to seeing everybody on September 8th.
Chad, I have to say, this is one of my, it's my favorite fundraising event of the year. It is such a good time, and there's so many people there. And it always seems to, I see the first announcement about midsummer when I am in my mind so far away from winter. But having the event on September 8th, and then really looking ahead to the winter, it sort of corresponds with how we have to look ahead to preparing for avalanche safety. It's really never too early to be, especially planning those avalanche safety courses that the Utah Avalanche Center offers, because they always fill up. Isn't that right?
They do. And so, yeah, Lynn, you nailed it. It's a perfect time to get your mind starting to think about snow. Personally, I think most of us think about snow year round, but for the rest of the people who are still dedicated to the trails in the summer, yeah, it's a good mindset shift and gets you into that mindset of, like, let's start thinking about, where's our gear? Does it still work? Have I practiced with my gear? Start getting things out of the closet. Have you taken a class? All the class providers now have their classes online, so you can register. The month of October, we consider awareness month, so we have anywhere from 3 to 10 awareness talks that are almost all free across the state every week. And so it's a great time to start thinking about that, which then takes you directly into the snow and avalanche workshop in November to really get more in-depth skills where you can learn from snow professionals, ski patrollers, guides, and whatnot. And then by that time, it's snow's on the ground. It's really time to get out there and get after it.
And I always like to say, starting early in the year, going on to the Utah Avalanche Center website and looking at the reports from the avalanche forecasters and really getting to know your snowpack, watching the weather so you know how it's lining up to be, because really, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, how it lines up early season many times determines how much avalanche danger there's going to be all season long unless things really change.
We tend to get some of these early October snowfalls every year, and that snow that falls on the ground in October, it might melt as we look up from Park City, and we may not see that snow, but go for a hike, get out into the higher elevations, and you might find that snow is still sticking around on the shaded north slopes. And that's the exact snow that come November, December, and January is our troubled weak layers, and that's where we see avalanches happen and often frequently accidents as well. So yeah, get out there in the fall and hike around and start creating a mental map of where is that snow that's starting to fall and where is it melted. And your safe slopes are very frequently going to be the first places that have melted snow, and so you don't have that pre-existing weak layer on them.
How deep do we need to go with our avalanche knowledge? It seems that a little bit of knowledge is sort of dangerous. And I remember when my children were school age, and all the kids, I think at least in Summit County, and you can tell me how many thousands see the Know Before You Go film at school, they told me, well, I have avalanche training. I saw the film and it's like a 12-minute film. And that really worried me. They thought they had knowledge, but they didn't really. So how deep?
Avalanche education is a lifelong journey. It doesn't really ever end. So you start with the Know Before You Go program. You then get into on-snow classes. And there's many hours and different types of classes you can take. But outside of that, there's the lifelong component is the continued learning, whether it's reading books, having a mentor, attending workshops, talking to guides, talking to snow professionals. And really, there's things to do every single season to learn more, to practice those skills. Like anything, if you don't practice the skills, you just never have them when you need them. And unfortunately, if you need them, it's probably an emergency, so they need to be second nature. Most snow professionals practice a couple hours a week on their rescue skills alone. And so it's a good bar to have of challenge your partners to a certain amount of practice every fall and during the winter. And put some wagers on it so that it makes sure it'll make sure that you do it.
If you're just tuning in, our guest on The Mountain Life is Chad Racklesberg, director of the Utah Avalanche Center, here to talk about the upcoming winter season and, of course, your upcoming big fundraiser. For folks who want to get more resources, UtahAvalancheCenter.org is the place to go. And is that also where they can get more information about not just the online courses that you offer, but is that where you'll post all your upcoming workshops?
It is, yes. So there is an events tab on the top that you can drop down to see everything that we have going on. And we're just starting to get a lot of our events scheduled. If you're interested in class, just use the education link. There's links there to free avalanche awareness talks as we get those scheduled, as well as all of the snow classes that we offer. And also as a resource to the community, all the local providers across Utah list their classes on the UAC website. So no matter what type of class you're looking for, you can find it from the UAC website.
Oh, great. Okay. And I imagine you can also get tickets to the Backcountry Benefit.
Yes, there's a big black bar across the top, and just click that. It will take you to the third-party site that manages our silent auction, and that's where you get your tickets. And tickets are $45, so we haven't changed the price, as everything seems to be more expensive. You know, the favorite party of everybody's is still the same $45. The tickets do go up to $50 on September 1st, though, so get them early.
Is it true that you sometimes sell out? It's such a huge space, I can't imagine.
We're trying to decide what sell out really means there, and we think that, you know, maybe 1,400 people might be selling out this year. So, yes, we could have to turn away people if you expect to get tickets at the door.
And the silent auction is always, as you said, a great place to get gifts. There are, I mean, literally hundreds of silent auction items. Can you preview a couple?
We'll have over 300 silent auction items, everything from skis, avalanche rescue gear, summer camping gear, lots of arts and crafts made by local artists, as well as great restaurant certificates from places up here like Tupelo and Yukiyama, as well as others. So really anything that goes, lift tickets, you name it, you can maybe find it.
Oh, yes. And that reminds me, my husband won a pair of skis last year in the raffle. So folks, believe me, this is a great fundraiser. So another couple, like expansion of your Know Before You Go campaign. It's taken some different, more in-depth faces over the years.
The Know Before You Go program is a program that's launched by the Utah Avalanche Center in 2004 after a pretty tragic accident at Aspen Grove down by Timpanogos, where three youths died in an avalanche on the 26th of December. If anybody lived here on December 26, 2003, you probably remember that storm. What we'd like to say is funny, that storm actually has its own Wikipedia page, so you can look it up. And I remember it took days for us to dig out of our house from that. But that tragedy sparked Craig Gordon and Bruce Tremper into knowing that there is no form of youth avalanche awareness anywhere in North America, and they had to do something about it. So they created the Know Before You Go program that launched the next winter, and it really took off. You know, we've reached over a 250,000 Utahns alone with that program, and it's now used globally. And so it's a great little program that is offered starting at 13 years old in the school systems. And since that inception, it was rebuilt in 2015. And then a year and a half ago, we partnered with Colorado Avalanche Information Center, the Northwest Avalanche Center, as well as Avalanche Canada, to rebuild the whole program. So coming October 4th, we're going to launch an entire new Know Before You Go program with all new presentation content, new website, new free online learning, and then new videos, which we will premiere. Our goal is to be accepted into Banff with a new 30-minute feature-length film that we will then show across the state in November.
That's great. Please send over to us here at KPCW all of that information. We will get it up on our community calendar, especially when you have the new resources online. And we want to be sure to get the word out to all of our Summit and Wasatch County listeners.
Yes, we're hoping for sometime November, December for a premiere of the movie up here in Park City. The whole program will premiere in person in Salt Lake on October 5th. We'll have details on the website in the next couple weeks for that, but we're planning live music, food trucks, and athlete presentations and discussions, as well as premiering the presentation itself. So that little premiere won't just be for the awareness crowd and the beginners backcountry user, that's really, we're looking at that as a kickoff for the backcountry community to come and celebrate this big accomplishment.
And I just want to say in kind of wrapping up here that the Utah Avalanche Center does, I mean, like you say, you're trying to get into the Banff Film Festival. They are not some amateur films. They're really incredible. And, you know, we all get excited about seeing our ski movies when they come out in the fall and early ski season. But I would say do not see any of those until you have seen all of the, not only the Know Before You Go, but the sort of documentary about the tragic accident that befell Ronnie Burlak and Bryce Assel in Austria. That one's called Off-Piste, right?
Correct. Off-Piste, Tragedy in the Alps is a movie that we created with the Brass Foundation that really highlights the dangers of avalanches and some of how that can just be so close, like we've seen here in Park City with the tragedies in Square Top and Dutch Draw.
Right. Absolutely. Chad Brackelsberg, director of the Utah Avalanche Center, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll see you at the party. We're going to get Sarah down there because...
Oh, yeah.
No, I hope so.
We were there last year. It's fantastic. Yeah. I was really hoping to win something in the raffle. I didn't realize the Bob did. But yes, we'll be there September 8th. Get your tickets now. Yeah.
Thanks, Chad.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, our next guest, Chris Magrill, has a long history of involvement in the biking world, and he is the ride director for the Summit Challenge, which takes place on Saturday, August 27th. That's coming up a week from Saturday. He joins us now to talk about the event. It raises funds for the National Ability Center, and it is just an all-around wonderful event. Chris, welcome to you.
Thanks. Good to be here, Lynn.
So did I say that right? You're the ride director. You kind of put this whole ride together. Are you on staff for the National Ability Center?
No, I've been a volunteer at the NAC doing Alpine programs since 2004. So I've been involved for a long time. I have friends and family members who are clients there, who've been employees there. So I understand the mission. It really matters to me. But I'm just a subcontractor for this event because, as you said, I've spent a lot of time in the bike world in lots of roles.
Yes, and it's really important for the safety of riders and letting the drivers out there know that they'll be expecting a lot of people on the road, especially in an event where, by nature of the fact that you have some of the participants, some of the students at the National Ability Center out doing the Discovery Loop on up to a century ride, you've got people all over the place. So talk about how you coordinate that.
We do have people all over the place. We have five distinct routes, four different start times. So 100 mile, 80, 50, 25, and 16, as well as the 1 mile discovery loop. So we break up the start times. We never have more than 200 people starting at one time. And so that helps spread it out quite a bit. The 100 mile people start at 7 in the morning and get out of the Snyderville Basin right away, head straight towards Camas. The other rides all go through the Snyderville Basin. The 16 and 25 spend a fair bit of time on non-motorized paths, the UP Trail, the McLeod Creek Trail, Silver Quinn, things like that. So it's places that can accommodate a little bit slower traffic, more hand cyclists, more recumbents.
I participated for the first time last year, and I am an amateur road biker, so a road cyclist. It was my first time. I did the 16, so it was lovely, wonderful course, and very well marked. I didn't get lost. I know last year, I think if I recall, the event coincided with the Alzheimer's walk. Do you know if that's happening again this year?
It is, and there's a slight okay. So there's a slight course overlap for about a half a mile, and only on one of our routes, on the 25 mile route, down in the Kimball Junction area.
Okay, so we'll look the for the day. Folks in the purple shirts and wave as mm-hmm. we ride by. Okay,
right, right. Yeah, we pride ourselves particularly on the course marking and course support. Of course, everybody can download the ride file from our website and follow along that way. But I don't think you should need to do that. I think it should always be really clear. So I've worked pro tour events. I understand what it's like to be with a group of people who are going 45, 50 miles an hour into a curve and how unsafe it is if you don't know in adequate time at that speed where you're going. So I try to mark the course. I make sure the course is marked for pro level speeds for the safety of all the participants.
Wow, pro level speeds, really, 45, 50 miles an hour, that's fast. Give us a preview of, or if you can sort of outline without too much detail, the 100 mile ride, where does it go? How many communities does it go through?
This is all in Summit and Wasatch County, but we're through 9 municipalities right now. The big draw on the 100 is that it's the only legal chance to ride through Wolf Creek Ranch. And for those of you who've pedaled through Wolf Creek Ranch, you know what a treat it is. After a really mean intro, the first hill is, I think it's the steepest paved hill in Utah. It's only 2 miles. The fastest amateur time is just under 15 minutes. Until last month, no woman had ever gone under 20 minutes for a 2 mile climb. But we spend 20 miles on the private roads in Wolf Creek Ranch. We come in the Summit County side over Woodland, Camas Valley, and drop out in the Heber Valley. Travel through the Heber Valley and then back up over past Jordanelle, go through Victory Ranch, again, private roads, hilly, and finish back up Browns Canyon. But for a lot of people, the 100 mile, the big draw is to see if they can conquer that Wolf Creek Ranch climb.
What percent grade is it?
It's 9.1, so but it's a steady 9.1. About a third of our participants end up walking some of it. We have a shuttle running there the whole time, and I'm there, and I'm trying to get people to get in the car. I'll drive them to the top so they don't blow their day on this two-mile segment. And they always say, do I have to? No, you can walk it if you want. I understand that idea of finishing it all on your own. We've had hand cyclists do it, which is amazing. The 50-50 climb with hand cycling. A couple of years ago, there's a phenomenally strong Ability Center athlete, a young man named Matt, who has one arm. He did that climb out of the saddle, one arm. So think about that. If you think you're strong, if you think you have bike skills, go to any short hill. You might want to try it on grass so when you fall over, you don't hurt yourself. But try to climb out of the saddle with one arm. And then, of course, that also meant he couldn't take a drink for that entire climb because he would have to sit down, and if he sat down, he couldn't pedal.
Wow.
So, massively strong athlete.
That is incredibly inspiring. So we're 10 days out from the race. August 27th, of course, is race day. Is there a cutoff to register, or can folks still register up until the night before race day?
No, registration closes on next Thursday, the 25th.
Okay.
We do, we have a cap on us, and we almost always hit it. We almost always hit it in the day or two before. Lots of people will wait to see the 10-day forecast or the 7-day forecast. So at some point next week, it will very likely sell out. There are a couple of hundred spots currently. So you can go on to the website at summitchallenge100.org or through the NAC's main website, discovernac.org. And that will get you to the website and the registration page. And just one slight clarification, we're really really aware of trying to refer to it as a ride. It's not a race.
Okay.
It's a ride where all participants are expected to stop at every stoplight and stop sign. We follow traffic laws. It's not a race. It's for all levels. And there will be people who go very fast and are very strong. And there will be people for whom the 16 mile will be a significant challenge. But we want everybody to come out and enjoy our community, be a part of our community. I love riding a bike, and so many people riding a bike, it was a part of their independence, their freedom, their joy. This is true for so many people in all stages of life and all abilities, and for people after an accident or an injury, that bicycle again is joy and freedom. This is one of the things that just keeps drawing me back to be a part of that community and see the joy and independence and freedom that a bicycle can bring to people.
That's great. And are you looking for volunteers?
Indeed, we are. We have a wide array of on-course volunteer options. If you go to our website or just call the NAC, they'll put you in touch with the volunteer coordinator. And some of it is standing on one specific corner with a safety vest and a flag for 1 hour to make sure that cyclists come through safely, especially for hand cyclists. You might have limited head mobility, so to look over your shoulder to see a car could be really challenging. So we're trying to make sure that all of our participants stay safe.
How are motorists these days? What I find as a motorist is that we are getting to this critical mass where no matter where you drive, there are cyclists all over the place. And so you just get to the point where this is who we are in this area, in this community, and drivers just need to be mindful of that. There's, no black puffs of diesel fumes that really, especially for the Summit Challenge, that you should be blowing into the faces of cyclists. It's not a war. It's that we're all doing what, people trying to stay healthy, come back from injuries, come back, help their disability and it's really, it's an important day, and it's important for all of us as motorized users to know that.
Yeah, we ask for a little bit of awareness and to take a steal a line from Charlie Sturgis in Mountain Trails, 10 seconds of kindness. Slow down for just 5 seconds. Make sure you pull over. Everyone stays safe. Everyone can keep their blood pressure down. Stay calm. About 1/3 of our participants right now are disabled vets, and you may or may not realize them as disabled vets as they're riding by on a bicycle. These are people who've done an awful lot for our country. We can slow down for 5 seconds, show 5 seconds of kindness. The people on the bike aren't necessarily the other. You don't have to be aggressive and hostile. We do our very best to not cause congestion. We go single file in tight places. There are a few places where we really can't avoid it. And if you're on a hand cycle, you're wider than an upright bike. There are going to be a few places where people are going to have to slow down a little more. We appreciate the kindness and the courtesy.
Well said. My favorite part of any ride, let's get to that, the aid stations. I remember in this ride when I did it, roasted potatoes with a lot of salt on them.
The salted potatoes are a huge part of this ride. It's an amazing pick-me-up. It's a simple, quick finger food. So, yeah, we will have roasted potatoes at many of the rest stops. The last year, we had a rest stop. Each rest stop is staffed by a different volunteer group from the community or a group from the community. State Park City won the best rest stop last year, the State Park City Cycling Club. They pulled out bacon. So that there's a hint to all the rest of you. That was the secret ingredient
Bring
the bacon. And then, of course, at the finish line, we have a party. We're providing food and beverage and encourage you to hang out for as long as you want as your friends come in and meet new friends and see the Ability Center campus. It's an amazing place and be a part of our community.
Yeah, I was going to say, I remember the burger last year tasted probably better than any burger I've had. but it is a great opportunity, especially for those in the community who might not spend a lot of time over at the NIC headquarters, to see the campus and, really just be part of that community spirit. Like you said, this is not a race. I take it back. Ride for all abilities, novice cyclists, all the way up to experts. Is there an age restriction to participate?
There is not. And we see a lot of families doing the 16 mile. For a lot of families, the 16 mile will be the biggest ride their kid has ever done, their child has ever done. And most of that route is on non-motorized or designated bicycle paths. So we feel really good about that for novice riders and for families.
Great. Well, Chris Magrill, thank you so much for what you do for the National Ability Center, and thanks for joining us this morning. Unfortunately, I'm out of town, so I can't do it this year.
Oh,
Sarah?
I'll be here. I will be here, yeah.
Great.
Wonderful. Look forward to seeing you. Thank you.
And we'll get all the information about the Summit Challenge up on the KPCW community calendar as well.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Chris.